Crazy. What do you think of when you hear that word? Cool? Trippy? That's crazy, man.
But for most of us, the word conjures up mad, bonkers, wacko, loony.
We didn't look away from Mark. And maybe that's why we felt it was important to tell his story, because we did not look away from him.
My depression is pretty heavy. Every day I wake up, I feel sick.
I knew something was wrong, but I didn't know what it was until they diagnosed me when I was in my early 20s.
Right to treatment.
We led the nation in making a lot of mistakes on this for a half century. Now I want to lead the nation on the next half century of fixing this.
For everybody, they think, how'd that happen? And then you see that people have been through every mechanism possible trying to get him help. And at every turn, the system has shut them out.
When I look at Mark, I will always see an 11-year-old kid telling me that he needs me.
I should warn you when I'm not well. I can't tell. Oh, there's nothing I can do to make this easier for you. You're gonna need to be patient with me.
The new documentary film, No One Cares About Crazy People, explores the mental health crisis in America through intimate personal stories and urgent social commentary. The film, directed and produced by Gail Friedman, was inspired by Vermont author Ron Powers' acclaimed book of the same name. Powers, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, shares his own family's tragedy, losing his younger son to suicide at age 20, while also following grassroots advocates working to reform the broken mental health system in the United States. No One Cares About Crazy People will screen at the Town Hall Theater in Middlebury, Vermont, this Saturday, September 6th at 2 p.m. Following the screening, director Gail Friedman and author Ron Powers will join other members of the film for a community discussion about it and on the ongoing mental health crisis. A portion of the proceeds will benefit Middlebury's Charter House Coalition. Filmmaker Gail Friedman joins us now. Gail, hello. Welcome back to the Roundtable.
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah.
How did this topic become the focus of several years of your work, and what drove you to create this incredibly compelling, moving, frightening, and upsetting film?
Thank you. I hope we can also add the word hopeful at the end of that.
Of course,
There was a three-part motivation, really. When I was a baby in the business at CBS News many years ago, Ron Powers was working there already, a Pulitzer Prize-winning veteran journalist, and we met and became friends. So I brought that history to the project. Also, very early in my career, I worked as a medical reporter. So as I always say, I'm every doctor's nightmare. I just know just enough to be difficult. And my own mother lived with a borderline personality disorder, undiagnosed and untreated for most of her life. But there was that lived experience, as they say. So it was really a kind of a three-part motivator that led me to feel that this was worth investing what turned out to be over 5 years of my life.
There is so much to get your arms around in the movie, from showing these individuals who suffer from severe mental illness, like very acute schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, to how government has approached it, other grassroots movements. How did you decide to frame it, and how did you find the participants of the film?
Well, I'll start with the last part of your question. The participants were remarkable, and they buoyed me throughout the process at times when it wasn't clear, because we started right before COVID. I mean, literally, we had filmed a day and a half with Ron Powers and his family before the shutdown occurred. So but that enabled me to really dig in deep on the research and to really get to know some of the people who ultimately became the key characters in the film, and their candor, their openness, their bravery, their trust in the process just blew me away. And the, you know, I began with Ron Powers' family story, but I wanted to also try to find some stories that we could follow in real time as they unfolded. And much of Ron's family story was in the past. And so I began, and I also wanted to be very inclusive and have different kinds of individuals and families. And so we began casting a wider net, and also learned that there was this kind of burgeoning of family advocacy movement, and that although that is nationwide and is continuing to grow, a lot of that activity was taking place in California. So in addition to Ron's family is in Vermont, which is why we're beginning the rollout of the film there. But we also, a lot of the film takes place in California. And so we wanted, you know, there are so many stories, and every story is unique, and yet there are such commonalities. And so it was, as it always is with any kind of a project, that balancing act of finding stories that were compelling, that were in process, that displayed different aspects of the story, and that threading through all this was this push to try to really reform a system that has probably been broken forever. But in particular, looking back at the last 50, 60 years in American history, some people know there used to be these large state institutions where people, in some cases, were locked up and not heard from or seen for many years. And then beginning in the 60s, there was the whole deinstitutionalization movement, which was very well-intentioned and intended, and the goal was to treat people in the community in a humane way where they had more agency and their lives could be reclaimed. So the institutions, many of them, most of them were shut down, but the robust community care never came through. The funding wasn't there, and seemingly the will was not there for many years. And so you ended up with a situation that we see today where far too many people with serious mental illness end up on the streets, imprisoned, or worse. And so that was kind of the context for this. So it was this constant juggle between the personal and the political, if you will, and wanting this to be story-driven and character-driven and something that, you know, we all see every day in our lives, but to try to put a very human face on that, but to also, and I mentioned the word hope before, to try to look at the emergence of this movement trying to get us to a different place. I think COVID brought mental health issues to the public's attention in some ways as never before, but for those who have the most serious illnesses, they got the short end of the stick before, and they still do. And so that's really where the focus of the film is, which is like sort of a long-winded answer to your question.
No, not at all. Not at all. Perfectly encapsulated. One of the families in the film is the Rippies. Mark Rippey is a blind and schizophrenic person who is living with a traumatic brain injury, who's living on the streets in California. But you also feature his sisters and his mother who are passionately, you know, attempting to care for him and working in the community to gain access to services for him. How did you find that family? And tell us more about them, please.
Oh, that story is extraordinary. And yes, well, actually, I met the Rippies through Ron Powers. Ron had been in communication with the family and had written about them on his blog. And so during COVID, I connected with them. And one of Mark's sisters, Mark's story was extraordinary. His family tried for decades to care for him. They he lived with them in their homes until that became unsafe. He had his own apartment and they would pitch in and help. And then because he was untreated, he set fires and he lost his supportive housing, and there he was in the streets, floridly psychotic, blind, and in really bad shape. And his sisters would go out and bring him supplies and food and canes and bedding, and they took, for lack of another phrase, home movies of him, because they were trying to document the dire circumstances and trying to the best of their ability in the face of unbelievable odds to get him help. Now, in some ways, Mark was a unicorn, you know, because he had a traumatic brain injury. The mental health services teams would say, well, you know, that should be his primary diagnosis. That should be his care. So then they go to that bureaucracy, and that bureaucracy would say, but no, he's schizophrenic, so the mental health people should be taking care of him. And Mark would just continually fall between the cracks, with no one ultimately except the family taking responsibility. And Mark did not know he was mentally ill, which is not an uncommon occurrence. In up to 50% of cases, there is a coexisting condition where it's not denial. It's not that the person's in denial, but a feature of their illness is that they do not know. And if you don't know you're sick, why would you go for treatment? Especially when it comes to medication, these medications are no free ride. They come with, you know, side effects and other things. So Mark would decline treatment. He would, and his family tried and tried and tried, and it was just one of the most tragic situations I've ever seen. And you know, Mark knew he was unhoused, and Mark wanted a place to live, but Mark was, it was a tough case, and many people did their best. His family would go and testify before the County Board of Supervisors. They would go and testify before the state legislature. Many people tried to help him, and his family became fierce advocates for him and for others like him in the process. And they're still at it. They're still warriors. And it was a privilege to meet Mark. We were together on 3 or 4 separate occasions. And even in the midst of his psychosis, he always remembered me. He was always incredibly polite. He was always open and willing to talk and try to the best of his ability to explain his struggle.
You also, in the film, Governor Gavin Newsom of California and State Senator Susan Eggman are featured. They speak to camera, and Susan met Mark on the street with you all. Excuse me. Why did you feel it was important to include those two politicians specifically?
Well, yes, we were very privileged that both of them participated. Gavin Newsom is a political lightning rod, but like him or not like him, Governor Newsom has taken on this issue as a signature issue in his administration, which politicians for decades have run the other direction because it tends to be a losing issue. But Newsom, too, has a personal stake in this, which is interesting because his mother's father came back from World War II with serious post-traumatic stress disorder and took his own life in front of his daughter, Newsom's mother. So Gavin Newsom also had a personal stake, but he also, I mean, you know, first of all, the issue of homelessness and mental illness, they are not synonymous, but there is obviously overlap. And in California, this issue is incredibly visible. And so on a purely political level, I think that Newsom in some ways was responding to public pressure to do something about this. But I think he also just really believed that there was a chance to remake this system and to pass some legislation and to really put serious resources into the issue. And so he took it on in a major way. And Susan Eggman, who is in the state Senate, she's now termed out, but she was the really the lead on a whole package of initiatives that they were trying to get through the legislature, trying not only to find other pathways to treatment, but also trying to come up with a continuum of care, because it does no good to put people who are in acute need into short-term care, stabilize them, and then put them right back out into the situation they were in before. There has to be a whole spectrum of housing. The advocates call it housing that heals. There has to be a whole continuum of housing. There has to be robust support services. And so they have tried to pass in California a whole package of legislation to address this at all these different points along the continuum. Much of the legislation did pass. We were able to follow that in real time, too. That's the advantage of being able to spend several years on a film, is that you can do things in real time. We don't know what the outcome's going to be. As Dan Moraine, a historian and author, says in the film, come back in 5 years and we'll do this again and we'll see how it's going. Because, you know, Newsom likes to say it's one thing to pass legislation, it's something else to implement that legislation. And it's been a rocky start on some of these laws, but they got through a $6.4 billion bond measure, which is supposed to actually put some teeth into some of this and make it possible to not just mandate care, but to also have it be robust and meaningful and promote recovery. So we'll see. But I thought it was very important to show not, you know, the individuals who live with these disorders and to center them, to center their families who live with it as well, but to also show that there are possible solutions and that there are politicians who are embracing this and rather than running away from it.
Our guest is Gail Friedman. The film No One Cares About Crazy People will screen at the Town Hall Theater in Middlebury, Vermont this Saturday, September 6th at 2 p.m. Links to more information will be posted along with this interview at WAMC.org. Gail, as you set out to make the film, you couldn't have an entirely concrete idea of what exactly it would turn out to be after so much work. What surprised you most as you proceeded through this lengthy and very detailed process?
That's an interesting question. You know, I think in some ways what surprised me most, even though it sounds so self-evident, is that almost every single one of us is impacted by this issue. I would talk to people over the last 5+ years as I was working on this, almost to each and every one would tell me somebody in their family, a friend, a neighbor, a coworker, someone they'd gone to school with. We are all touched by this, not only seeing it every day and hearing it in the news in some ways almost every week, but in our own lives. And I think the universality of that was something that did surprise me, but that also encouraged me, because I think if we can depict that and we can attract a broad audience to this, we can really make some difference in the world, which sounds perhaps naive, but I don't think so. I think we're at a tipping point when it comes to this subject, and I hope in some small way that we can be part of that.
I want to finish up our conversation with by far the most superficial element, but still very cool part of the film, which is that you have narration by the incredible actor Bob Odenkirk and original music from Wilco's Jeff Tweedy. How did these two gentlemen, who I know also have experience with mental illness, I'm sure that was a part of it, in their families or themselves, how did you acquire their talents for your film?
Oh, the gifts of those men are just a huge blessing to us. Bob Odenkirk is a remarkable human being, incredibly smart, one of the most voracious readers I've ever encountered. And among the things that he read was Ron's book, which I highly recommend to your listeners if they have not read it. It's just a brilliant book, and began this film. Anyway, Bob read Ron's book and sent him a note telling him much he thought of it. And I then hijacked that relationship and started communicating with Bob, who offered to narrate the film, which was just extraordinary. And Bob's an old Chicago boy in his roots, and so is Jeff Tweedy. Mm-hmm. And Bob connected me to Jeff, and Jeff graciously consented to do the original music for the film, which, again, just two extraordinary gifts. And we are so grateful. And, it doesn't get better than that.
It really doesn't. I mean, I wouldn't say that their contributions are the most impactful part of the film, but it does give it a polish and a beauty that will hopefully get more eyes on it than it might otherwise if the topic was, off-putting to a potential viewer. Maybe one of those celebs can bring them in and then they'll learn something.
Well, exactly. I mean, that is the hope, obviously. It's a tough climate for social issue documentaries right now. But we know the audience is there, and we're already in the process of setting up screening events all over the country, and indeed in some other countries as well, and look forward to broadcast and streaming after that, and really really trying to make some good trouble, as the expression goes.
Indeed. It is an incredibly made and, as you said, hopeful, while also being, truly devastating with the realities of what people are facing out there, but also lending hope and shining a light on it. Gail, thank you very much for the film and for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much, Sarah. It's been my honor and my pleasure.
To learn more about Gail Friedman's documentary, No One Cares About Crazy People, visit noonecaresfilm.com. The screening at the Town Hall Theater in Middlebury, Vermont is this Saturday at 2 p.m. townhalltheater.org for more information. Again, that's noonecaresfilm.com. You can see the trailer for the film there. Or to learn more about the screening this weekend in Vermont, townhalltheater.org. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable.